Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man who has waged that war in a number of important capacities, both in uniform and now in the Congress of the United States. As our first guest, he is Representative Steve Russell. He represents the people of the 5th District of Oklahoma, serves on the House Armed Services Committee, and is the Vice Chairman of the National Security Subcommittee of the House Committee on Government Oversight and Reform, and always a welcome guest here. Congressman, welcome back. Good to have you with us, sir.
Well, thank you, Frank. I appreciate it.
You spent time in combat in Iraq. You rose to the rank of a lieutenant colonel, I believe, before you got out. You doubtless have some firsthand insights into what those soft guys are doing that the president is now proposing to put into Syria. 250 more. What do you make of it, and what strategy are they executing, as best you can tell?
I think it's important to bear in mind that troop requests are almost always generated from the field. So as I look at it from a warrior's perspective, I imagine that there were some requests for additional capacity on the ground within the limits that field commanders thought that would be reasonably considered. I don't know what those original requests were. They typically, though, in practice, whatever gets requested is usually reduced. So here we see the president granting 250. I have no idea what was originally asked for. I find it odd that the president somehow is being viewed as him making this request and commitment to send in 250 troops, and then people scoffing at the small number and all of that. But I got to tell you, from a warrior's perspective, the combatant commander was probably approached by the warriors in the field saying, look, we've got to have some additional troops to, you know, to get these tasks accomplished. They go and they make that case. They meet with the National Security Advisor or with the you know, Secretary of Defense, whoever it might be, whatever it might be framing up as, or it may even be direct conversations between the combatant commander and the president. Next thing you know, there's an authorization. So a lot of background behind that. I look at it, and I don't see it as something that, you know, is trying to be some political football that they're just going to throw out a little number out there and, you know, try to make it look like they're doing something when it really is nothing or whatever. This had to have bubbled up from a field request, more than likely.
But let me ask you, assuming that's the case, and that sounds reasonable, and, you know, if the combatant commanders in the field think that this is what they need or something approaching what they need.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they needed more.
Probably so.
But this is what they got.
But let me just ask
better
you,
than nothing.
Steve, you've again, been in this fight, albeit with different enemies.
Sure.
And in a slightly different part of the geography in the Middle East.
Different circumstances.
Well,
yeah.
I'm wearing a different banner maybe at the moment, but you're right. It's the part of the global jihad for sure. When you look at what you're up against there, and you look at the idea that we're going to put 250 on top of the 50, I guess, that we're supposed to have in Syria at the moment, is there a strategic purpose to this, as best you can tell? And if so, do you think this is likely to accomplish that end? Or is this just what the combatant commanders are just hoping to do to sort of keep a lid on things?
I go back to my original comment that this was probably generated from the field. Since they are special forces or special operations forces, those are strategic assets. They're not necessarily tactical assets, although they can be used in that capacity. So obviously they were asked for that purpose. And they were granted. As I read 250, that tells me we're talking a if it's special forces, we're talking perhaps a battalion-sized unit with support. If it's not, we're talking some other elements on the special operations side of various size and support. Regardless, this is not a huge number, but it would be a strategically important number. And again, I would almost be willing to take to the bank that the original request was probably larger.
Yeah, I guess so. Let me switch gears. You do know this enemy. As you say, you met them up close and personal in Iraq. A number of them wound up in Guantanamo Bay. The president seems determined to send people elsewhere, if he can't bring them here, to empty that facility before the end of his time in office. I know as a member of the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman Steve Russell, you've been opposed to, bringing those guys here. What's your current reading on what is likely to happen? Are we simply repopulating the jihadist leadership with what are considered to be rock stars, the people who were incarcerated?
Well, I think the solution is the taxpayers spent an enormous amount of money building a courtroom for war tribunals in Guantanamo Bay. I've toured the facility. It's very nice, very adequate. Let's have the war tribunals.
Very secure,
among others. The president has that authority, and he could say, look, I want these war tribunals. I want you to get it done. Instead, we see a lot of political shenanigans going on where they're trying to either transfer these people to U.S. soil, which is problematic because then they're afforded, certain liberties, while they would be on U.S. soil in custody. We don't want that. That would further complicate bringing them to justice. At the same time, if they're going to release them, I got to tell you, the guys that were sent to Gitmo had some direct link in the killing of U.S. Service personnel. That doesn't sound like somebody like, okay. I mean, if I committed murder, it's not likely I would come up for parole in 6 to 8 years and be released with no strings attached other than, I'm kind of on house arrest with larger borders like country. This is a problem. Okay, so how do you overcome all of that? You overcome all of that by having war tribunals. Grant the authority. The authority is there. The provisions are there. And then what you say is, okay, time served and innocent, gone. Or guilty, but time served is meet to the sentence that we actually found guilty of, or they were capitally guilty and therefore they're deserving of execution or life imprisonment.
And then carry out the sentences as appropriately. Yeah. Hey, Congressman,
let's do that.
We're almost out of time, and I do want to talk about one other subject with you. Again, having served in uniform and having been part of sort of the national security apparatus of the United States, I'm sure that you have an appreciation of the role of the National Security Council. And there are reports that it has become bloated. Some 400 people serve on it now, and that it's been micromanaging the Defense Department, according to three Obama Secretaries of Defense, no less. There is an effort, apparently by your chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Mac Thornberry, to include some language to try to lock things down a bit in that regard, this sort of overreaching by the NSC in the National Security Decision Authorization Act. Give us a sense of how that looks from the Hill as you see it now, and whether that amendment will pass, do you think?
Well, we're certainly looking at any way that we can streamline headquarters elements, that we can make our defense more efficient. Now, on the security pieces, obviously, these are advisors to the president. We want them to get the best counsel and wisdom and benefit of people's security and uniform expertise. But that said, here we have an example where you have both the Defense Department or GAO or whatever it might be, but then it's come out and recommended that we cut back, scale back, or make changes. And I think, although you would have to ask Chairman Thornberry himself, I suspect that this is what has driven a lot of this call And I do think that it will be well received when we get into the markup.
Good. We'll be following it closely as we do your efforts, Congressman. Steve Russell of the House Armed Services Committee, the author of We Got Him, a memoir of the hunt and capture of Saddam Hussein. As always, we're appreciative of your service to our country in uniform, sir, as well as that you're rendering now for the people of the 5th District of Oklahoma. Keep it up. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Diana West, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined, I'm very pleased to say, as we are each week, by our friend and inspiration, our muse, I think it's fair to say, Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, now a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, and the author of two superb books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana, it's great to have you back with us, as always. Hello.
Hello. Thank you. Very good to be back.
Let me talk to you about a couple of things that came out of President Obama's trip to Europe last week that I have the feeling struck you as both odd and problematic, as they did me. One was his statement to the German chancellor in a press conference that she was, quote, on the right side of history, unquote, because she was basically permitting her borders to remain open to, well, I guess, millions of migrants, many of them hailing from countries that have a very different culture, tradition, and attitude towards Western civilization, to the point. Talk a bit about that, Diana, that characterization and its implications.
Yes, well, this was a stunning moment. This was a very important moment in our recent times, because here we see the President of the United States essentially making it clear in his conference with the Chancellor of Germany the extent to which they are involved in what is, to me, a criminal enterprise that is destroying Western civilization as it has been based on the evolution of the nation state. This can't be underscored enough in terms of understanding when he says that Merkel is on the right side of history. He is simply giving his imprimatur to this continued destruction that will bring in this new day, this global new day. And it, what I hear echoed here, it's almost a perfect bookend in some ways, is going back to President Obama's very famous speech at the UN when he said the future must not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam.
Yeah. Diana West is our guest, and we're talking about the attitudes of some Western leaders, including our own, to the preservation of our national identities and culture and civilization. And Diana, you made the comment, and I think it bears repeating, that the President of the United States uttered a phrase from the platform of the United Nations 2 weeks after the murderous attack on our facilities in Benghazi that, quote, the future must not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam, unquote. You could have heard that phrase from the mouths of bin Laden or Hassan al-Banna or Yusuf al-Qaradawi or Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. I mean, the jihadis themselves. What's up with that?
Well, but keep in mind the progression of the last several years, twinned with this idea that Merkel is on the right side of history, which means that he is on the same side of history. The people coming into Europe at this point are mainly Islamic men. The friction, the struggle, the civil war that is unfolding before our eyes in Europe and will be here in its different form in our situation is exactly the kind of struggle that those who would slander the prophet of Islam in terms of rejecting the prophet of Islam are engaged in, and they must be held down. And what we see across Europe is this struggle whereby those who simply wish to remain and preserve the culture that they have, which is Christian-based, European, the various peoples of Europe as they've developed in the different countries, they are being told that they cannot defend themselves or even exist in their traditional incarnation. And President Obama and Chancellor Merkel and all of the other leaders on the left and the center-left who rule in Europe, there is no conservative government in Europe at this time that is simply traditionalist in its orientation. There is none. There are some vigorous parties, but there is no leadership there. On top of that, we have the EU, which is another vector of destruction.
And I want to come
this
to that
is
next.
Where yes, and this is exactly what's going on, and they are actually stating it now, as if there is nothing to be done about it.
And Diana, you know, one of the things that, one of the things that I prize so much about our conversations is, I think, the perspective that you bring in understanding how something like this can go down. You've, of course, documented it brilliantly in your book about communism and how the United States was really betrayed by those who didn't want to slander
the prophet of Lenin.
Yeah. Let me just ask you, when you hear this, one of the things, of course, that's a corollary to it is, of course, the purpose behind that comment by the president at the UN, namely silencing expression that offends Muslims. And this is really the handmaiden, isn't it, of this effort to pervert, manipulate, undermine, ultimately destroy Western civilization, is if you can't talk about what's going on or object to it in some sort of public expression, you really are far, far less capable of doing anything about it.
Yes, well, exactly. Because if you can't talk about things, you certainly can't drive a political movement of change or defense or war or
resistance.
Anything else
yeah.
to make these ideas manifest. I mean, this is they become demonized, and those who utter them become demonized or dehumanized or indeed punished by the state. We're seeing in Germany very recently people who were actually arrested for posting song lyrics on social media that were considered against the prevailing doctrine. So this is how bad it's getting, and it is the mechanism of the state coming down, whether it's a soft totalitarianism in that there are also public services and other kinds of, you know, inducements, but it is a security state nonetheless that is squelching dissent and making this Islamic wave possible. And this is where we are.
Yeah. In one other respect, I wanted to come back to something you talked about, and that is kind of the red-green axis, if you will, here, that does so much to enable this insinuation of Sharia and the Islamist agenda in places like Europe and, well, if they have their way here. And that is evidenced in the supranational entity known as the European Union, with its sort of socialist agenda, its unaccountable Eurocrats and the like. Here again, the president was on that side of history, if you will, insisting that the British must remain part of the European Union if they wish to have any kind of intercourse with us in the United States. And I'd love to get your thoughts on that as well, quickly.
Yes, well, this is part of the globalist project, and people should also be thinking about this in terms of our own proto-EU formation, which, of course, begins with these global trade organizations known as, in shorthand, TPP. There's a TPA for the Atlantic Ocean, the TPP being the Pacific region. These are the kinds of supranationalistic or non-nationalistic trading organizations from which the European Union grew. It started as a free trade zone and became a super government. This is exactly why we see this as such a electric issue in the campaign this year. It's one of Donald Trump's main centerpieces of his campaign. It is, people need to understand that the way we lose sovereignty is in these global trading organizations. And this, I think, people are getting, which is, I think, a lot of what Donald Trump's appeal actually is involved with, because he sees this, and this is something in Washington most people do not. Certainly in the Republican Party, most people are all about free trade, and it doesn't matter if sovereignty is the casualty. That's where we are. We can look to Europe,
Diana,
to see how
where
that
we are, alas,
out.
Is out of time. This is a subject on which we will return often, I'm sure, in the days ahead. Donald Trump had a big night last night, and it certainly is likely that this contributed to it in Republican primary voters. I appreciate so much your time, Diana. As always, come back to us again next week, and we'll talk with you then. Next up, we'll be talking with Seth Cropsey about a new grand American strategy and why it's urgently needed. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin is among our country's most skilled, accomplished, and decorated warriors. As a longtime member and leader of America's elite special forces and intelligence community, he has fought our enemies and understands them better than just about anybody. On Glenn Beck's radio show this week, General Boykin warned about Grover Norquist, a man he confirms has been enabling some of our most dangerous enemies, Islamic supremacists, including terrorists, here inside the United States. His confirmation that a subversive Islamist fifth column has been helped in its influence operations against our government and civil society institutions could not be more timely or important. Members of the National Rifle Association are voting on whether Norquist should continue to serve on that organization's board of directors. General Boykin and Glenn Beck urge NRA members to recall Grover Norquist. So do I. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined, I'm pleased to say, by Seth Cropsey, a man whom I've come to know and admire greatly for his work in government, as well as these days at the Hudson Institute, where he is a senior fellow and director of its Center for American Sea Power. In previous incarnations, he worked for my old boss, Cap Weinberger, as an assistant to the Secretary of Defense. He also served as a deputy undersecretary of the Navy in both the Reagan and H.W. Bush administrations, among other incarnations in the office of the Secretary of Defense, including as an acting assistant secretary. Quite a pedigree and quite a lot of insights into the national security challenges of our day. Seth Cropsey, you are always welcome here. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Frank.
Let's talk a little bit about this piece that you had at Rear Clear Defense recently, which I thought was very important and very, very well argued, namely calling for a new grand American strategy, or new American grand strategy, I guess I should say. Let's give us the need for it first and the broad outlines of it as you see it.
Frank, the purpose of the main goal of American foreign policy since the beginning of the founding of the Republic has been to not only advance democracy, but to prevent hegemonies in Europe. As the strategic threats to the United States increased, Europe came to include the possibility of a hegemony, a Soviet hegemony, and today includes the possibility of a Chinese hegemony and an Iranian hegemony, regional hegemonies. If this is allowed to happen, the United States will end its status as a superpower. If Russia controls the Eurasian landmass, or pretty much influences what goes on there, NATO is just a fiction. If Iran controls the Middle East, the impact on our energy supplies and the prospect for democracy in the region and for anything approaching peace and stability goes away. China's success, if it succeeds in becoming the hegemon of Asia, has extraordinary impact on our security relations with our five treaty allies in Asia, and not much less our economic presence in the region. So it's really curtains for the United States if this happens.
And what you indicated in this this think piece of yours was it's in a way worse than that, because if these hegemons align with one another, as they obviously are doing, matters get vastly worse. I had on the show yesterday a fellow you've dealt with in the past, Dr. Peter Navarro, and he was talking about Chusha as a kind of marriage between two of these hegemons, as you call them. You throw in their relationship with Iran, which is clearly a building. Matters get considerably worse. And describe, if you would, Seth, how such a prospect really demands of us a very different strategy than the one we've been pursuing. And again, it's broad outlines.
Well, if we allow this to happen, and you're right, and Peter Navarro is right, that with the interoperability of weapon systems and the increasingly warm relations between Russia, Iran, and China, who would all like to poke us in the eye, the prospect for the United States' ability to manage alliances from the West Pacific to Europe to even our own backyard, Latin America, the Caribbean, diminishes. And if we fail to take that seriously, it's simply impossible to overstate the consequences.
So what should we be doing about it, Seth? I want to get at this idea of the grand strategy that you would recommend.
Yes. Those three countries and regions share several things in common, but one is geographical accessibility to the water. Europe, including the western part of Russia, is essentially a peninsula bordered by the Northern Seas, the Mediterranean, and the Atlantic Ocean. The Middle East has access to the water by the Mediterranean, Persian Gulf, the most important part because of its the oil that comes out of there. So what I'm saying is that at the very minimum, we need to get more serious about a naval presence, a sea power presence that counters that threat, that lets our allies in all those regions know that we're there for them, that is able to protect our investments in the area, and I don't mean simply commercial investments, but security as well, and diplomatic with hard power, and that if we don't start to see things that way, all those important elements of American power are going to be diminished, ultimately with the most serious consequences.
Yeah. Speaking of Peter Navarro, Seth Cropsey, you spoke with him recently for some of the work that he's been doing in connection with his book and his film, Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World. And you had some data. I know it's also to be found in your terrific book, May Day, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. But the statistics that you cite about the shape and the numbers of our maritime combat vessels, the fleet, the Navy of the United States is simply staggering. Would you just give us a short appreciation of what's in prospect there?
Frank, the fleet today is less than half the size it was during the Reagan administration. It's the smallest since World War One, since before World War One. During the Obama administration, it shrunk from 280-odd ships to about 270 ships. The Navy's shipbuilding plan for the future, and this is according to the Congressional Research Office, so this is not this is a nonpartisan estimate. the Navy shipbuilding budget in order to increase the Navy does not supply the funds. So the shipbuilding accounts would have to increase to something like 25 to 30% over their average for the past 30 years in order to reach the Navy's stated goal. And that goal, my opinion is probably about 15 to 20% short of what's needed, of what the combatant commanders, America's combatant commanders say is required in order to defend American interests around the world. So we're on a downhill slope.
What you said in this conversation with Peter was, I think, verbatim, quote, "We could go from slightly over 100 deployable ships to 75 or so within the next 5 or 6 years." This isn't just, you know, the state of the Navy in 2030. This is imminent. 75 deployable naval combatants leaves huge areas of the world. I don't need to tell you, the author of Mayday, in a circumstance in which we are simply inviting enemies to fill the vacuum of power to our great detriment, aren't we?
Well, and that's exactly what's happening. When you look at what China is doing in the South and East China Seas, when you look at what Iran is doing by way of advancing its nuclear program and testing ballistic missiles and intermediate-range missiles, when you look at the large increases in the Russian Navy and those that are planned for the future, it's clearly an understanding on the parts of those three countries' leadership that the United States is receding in terms of its military power and its naval power especially, and this is a good time to take advantage of it. And their shipbuilding program and their missile program, their aircraft, naval aircraft program, all say the same thing.
They do indeed, in the starkest of terms, and what they say beyond about our future security as well as our vital interests is very, very grim indeed. Seth Cropsey, we appreciate your analysis and the work that you do at the Hudson Institute. I look forward to another conversation with you about all of this very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Rowan Scarborough about some other aspects of what I think can only be described as Obama's war on the U.S. military. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Rowan Scarborough, one of the best national security correspondents in the country. He writes for the Washington Times and has done so for, well, the better part of three decades. He is also the author of Rumsfeld's War: The Untold Story of America's Wartime and Anti-Terrorist Commander, and Sabotage: America's Enemies Within the CIA. Rowan Scarborough, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
It's good to talk to you, Frank.
You have been doing an extraordinarily important job, it seems to me, Rowan, in terms of your reportage on a part of what's happening to our military. I kind of think of it, to use Barack Obama's favorite phrase, as a fundamental transformation of America's military that goes beyond what we can all see pretty clearly, namely the kind of wrecking operation associated with his budget cuts and now sequestration and the impact that that's having on the readiness and the modernization and the research and development and other necessary investments in our military. But What you've been covering faithfully and very effectively, it seems to me, is sort of the other piece of all of this, the sort of war on the culture, for a better want of a better term, of the United States Armed Forces. Talk a little bit about that at the macro level, and then we'll drill down on some of the specifics. Rowan Scarborough.
Frank, I don't think there has been a commander-in-chief who has had a bigger fundamental impact on the military's culture, and successfully, and from his point of view, than Barack Obama. He has changed the way we think about what a combatant should be, a ground combatant or an air combatant. He has focused much of the OSD, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, on sexual issues, on gender issues. I mean, right now there is a big task force studying the whole issue of transgenders and whether they should be allowed in the military. Can they have surgery? What are our bathroom and shower rules going to be? Things like that. Stuff that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you would never think the Pentagon would spend time on because they have so many other things to do. And that's what has happened to the military. And they are now under orders to bring more women into the service, to put more women in more occupations, including ground combat and special operations, things that are taking an enormous amount of time. Some would say a distraction, dominating how the military spends its 24/7 day week trying to get soldiers ready to fight. And we know Army brigades today are not ready to fight a war. Many of them are not. Marine aviation is in crisis. Yet a lot of the focus right now of the White House is on a social military, not so much a combat military.
And transforming it, as I say, more and more from sort of a social engineered entity from one that actually can do what the nation requires it to do, which is to fight and win its wars. And one of the things, Rowan, again, you've sort of set the buffet for us. Let's go into it in some detail. One of the things that has been happening, of course, is the preoccupation with the green agenda, climate change, and the sort of focus on trying to make sure that the military is not impacting the environment. What does that translate into in practice, Rowan Scarborough, as you see it?
In practice, it now means that every combatant command, whether it's the Pacific or the Middle East, now, and when they sit down to do scenarios on how we're going to attack Iran or stop Russia, they have to inject climate change into their war plan. That is an edict that the Obama Pentagon put out in January, a fairly lengthy executive direction from Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense's office. So you must, when you're doing contingency planning for war, and you're going to present this to OSD, it has to have climate change within the battle plan. And that, again, this is something that 10, 15 years ago would never have been thought of, that this would happen to the military.
Well, it would have perhaps been thought of, but it would have been dismissed out of hand as absolutely ridiculous. Is there any evidence that you're aware of, Rowan Scarborough, or that you've been able to determine the intelligence community, for example, of the joint staff of the Pentagon, is aware of that has a similar kind of calculation being injected into the plans of Russia or China or North Korea or Iran? And if not, might we be hamstringing our military to wage, should they have to, decisive and successful combat operations against an enemy that's under no such constraints?
Yes, Frank, I don't think the Islamic State worries about climate change when they try to take over a village and slaughter, you know, 2,000 more Christians. And in this air campaign against ISIL, we're already seeing climate change. So one of the reasons we did not bomb their oil tankers, which are their prime source of revenue to pay their fighters, is because we didn't want to splatter oil on the desert and on highways.
So it wasn't just trying to protect the lives of the truck drivers. It was this environmental degradation that was of concern.
Exactly. Well, it wasn't just that they didn't want to kill truck drivers, which is another issue, but they didn't want oil spills that would have to be cleaned up.
Let me ask you about something else, Rowan. This is, you know, a cloud cuckoo land, it seems to me, frankly, if you're serious about the business of war, and I think we can't afford to be otherwise. white privilege training. What is that? And what precedence does it seem to be taking, that and, you know, diversity training and sexual conduct training and the like, that seems to be superseding, at least in part, if not in whole, the training for actual military operations?
White privilege is another one of these phenomenon theories that that has bubbled up from the left-wing movement. It's up there with microaggression and safe spaces. And it basically teaches that the white race is a bad race, that it's done a lot of things wrong, and that it needs to reform itself. And if you're sitting there in the audience, a white person, and you listen to the lecture, you're basically told that your life was handed to you and with a golden spoon, and you have dominated and discriminated against people of color. That's what the basic lecture is about.
It sounds sort of racist to me. Am I missing something here, Rowan?
You know, I would think you could see it as anti-white racism. I think that's how you could look at it.
I suspect that's how a lot of military personnel are looking at it. And again, it comes against the backdrop of an effort that's now, I think you've documented this in your reporting, Rowan Scarborough of the Washington Times, where diversity recruitment is now being given a priority over merit. And that really goes to the core, as you were talking about it earlier, of the military culture, doesn't it? That this is the ultimate meritocracy.
It's another edict that has come out of the Pentagon. You know, women make up about 14% of the active force, and they want to push that number a lot higher. They want to get more women to join the military, meaning less men would be in the military. You know, I think that effort has already been going. I mean, the military recruits very hard to try to get a good pool of candidates, and they recruit women very hard. And if women are not joining at the rates that Obama civilians want them to join, I think that's just what the market is showing. It's not necessarily showing that they don't want women. It's just showing that they're not getting the numbers at recruiting stations that they would like. And guess there are sociological reasons for that.
Yeah, well, and perhaps the prospect that they might be forced to go into combat is another consideration. That's a subject for another day's conversation with you. Rowan Scarborough, again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing to help illuminate these pieces that can bear directly on the morale as well as the fighting trim of the only military we have. I fear it's being broken, and it's imperative that as we go into this process of picking the next commander-in-chief, that the problems you're identifying not only be recognized but also remedied. Keep up the good work you're doing, my friend. Next up, we'll be talking with Louise Fleischman, the editor of the Americas Report with the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project, the Center for Security Policy, about Venezuela, Brazil, Cuba, and more, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by a colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, our senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project and the editor of its Americas Report. He is Dr. Luis Fleischman. He's also an adjunct professor of political science and sociology at the Wilkes Honor College at Florida Atlantic University, and the author, most recently, of Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, The Security Threat to the United States. Dr. Fleischman, good to have you back with us. Welcome.
A pleasure to be here, like always, Frank.
Well, your book, it would seem, is extraordinarily timely and topical even now. You wrote it in 2013, but the post-Chavez age continues to unfold with particularly troubling implications for the long-suffering people of Venezuela, his country. Give us a sort of status report, Luis, as to what the latest is there. We're hearing about blackouts and the work week being reduced to 2 days for government employees. What on earth is going on, and where is it likely to go from here?
Well, I think the situation is, as you describe it, Frank, is really serious, because if you have to shut down Wednesday and Thursdays, and 2 working days a week, that means that people would be working 3 days a week. Try to imagine, you know, that is not happening obviously in the most developed countries. The fact that Venezuela is doing it is not because there is too much wealth there, but the opposite is in order to prevent the workers from spending or wasting too much electricity. In other words, it's basically trying to save, you know, the electricity wasted in industrial work. The situation is really collapsing in Venezuela, and something very interesting happened, which I believe is totally related, is that the Venezuela's Electoral Commission yesterday released documents that would allow opposition politicians to collect signatures to begin the process of removal of President Maduro through a recall referendum. Interesting, because until now, the Electoral Commission and even the courts oppose it. And for some reason, now there is a change. Now, what we have been seeing in Venezuela is that little by little, many allies of the current regime have been abandoning the regime, have been abandoning President Maduro.
It's the old rats leaving a sinking ship phenomenon, it sounds like.
That is exactly right. And remember what happened in the last election. That was the Minister of Defense that basically vetoed the fraud that was planned by the government of Maduro on the last election. So, I mean, I don't want to be too optimistic when it comes to Venezuela, because, you know, I've been watching this, you know, this phenomenon for the last 15 years. But it looks like the political system is also collapsing, and hopefully it will come to a happy end in Venezuela. It's difficult for me to say that. It's the first time in 15 years that I'm saying that. And I think it's also the result of the great work of the assembly that was elected recently in November.
Well, let me ask you, Luis, the president, Nicolas Maduro, has claimed that this is all the fault of El Nino, that the lack of rain is afflicting the hydroelectric system and causing these disruptions, and everything will get better when it starts raining again. Obviously, you don't buy that, and it sounds as though more and more the Venezuelan people don't buy that. If this referendum that you've described is in fact going to go forward, is it your expectation that this would result in the recall? And if it were, is there some process in place, Luis Fleischman, to, in an orderly fashion, replace this president with someone who will put the country on a better footing and begin to fix what ails it?
Well, I believe that there is already some responsible leadership developing in the assembly. To tell you the truth, I was extremely surprised by the way the leadership of Ramos Alup, Henry Ramos Alup, you know, the so-called speaker of the House, the assembly, you know, I'm trying to translate it in American terms, has been conducting himself and actually keeping unity, which is remarkable. So I believe that if there is a transition, it's going to be orderly. The question is how to deal with people's patience. You know, people are living in horrible conditions, and the question is whether people will not continue to blame the next government for what is going on. So that is my concern, that, you know, the anger can explode into something bigger and may not explode in Maduro's face, but it may explode in the next government's face. That's my concern.
Well, especially with all that he has done, as you've documented, Luis, among other things in your book, Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, the security threat to the United States, that the lengths to which he's gone to arm, you know, his partisans and create conditions under which there could well be violence in a new government should it come to power. Let me turn to another part of your portfolio, Luis, that is also being racked by political turmoil at the moment and economic difficulties as well, namely Brazil. the host shortly of the Summer Olympic Games, also one of the countries in which the Zika virus is much in evidence. But impeachment is the order of the day. Talk a bit about what's happening to Dilma Rousseff and her prospects, and for that matter, those of Brazil.
Oh, well, at this point, Frank, it looks like Dilma Rousseff has no chance. The House actually voted overwhelmingly, more than two-thirds voted to impeach Rousseff, and now is awaiting for a vote in the Senate, and the Senate is expected to pass. And usually the Senate is not going to vote against the will of Congress that actually, you know, went, as I said before, more than two-thirds. The problem, and as I mentioned in the article that you just quoted, is that what is happening, what is going to happen the day after? I think the fact that Dilma Rousseff is gone, I think is basically a fact. I don't see any, she's not going to run away. But the problem is that those who are going after her in the political system in Congress are people that are also involved in corruption. So my problem is, again, it's the same like we discussed in Venezuela, but different a little bit. What is going to happen in Brazil the day after? I mean, when the people who are likely to succeed her, which are Michel Temer, the current vice president, that belongs to a different party, it's a party that was in coalition with the Workers' Party of Dilma Rousseff. He himself is also suspected of committing acts of fraud and cheating and corruption, and not to speak of the Speaker of the House, who has been a leader in impeaching Rousseff. He basically is accused of a money laundering scheme for $40 million. So what is going to happen next? So the good news is that yesterday the judges announced that they will continue to investigate corruption in general, even if the next government opposes it. That, I think, is very healthy, and I think that is important because corruption, in my opinion, is a much worse problem than economics. And, you know, Latin Americans are so used to the idea that economics is their main problem, but corruption steals money. Corruption is horrible. Corruption basically brings the drug cartels. Drug cartels actually are buying the police in Mexico, in Honduras, probably also in Brazil. And in Argentina. So corruption, in my opinion, should be the number one priority. And I think in the United States, we should assist Latin American countries, again, to build their state, so to speak. I know that's not a very popular idea, but...
Well, look, there are things that we can do short of nation building that can help nations recover from these kinds of disastrous policies and worse, aggressively anti-American governments. Luis, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though. We'll be talking with you more about all of these issues. We appreciate the work you do with the Americas Report and the Mencus Hemispheric Security Project of the Center for Security Policy. Keep it up. We'll talk soon. I hope we'll speak with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.